Thank you. My name's Carl. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Carl.
Chomping at the bit tonight. Chomping at the bit. Gonna have to remind me what I said last week, but I know I really didn't get into the book. It was more about AA history and about my history and what qualifies me to talk about this stuff. And my buddy Dave is here. Dave recalls that when we started up at New Providence with the Back to Basics book, the Wally P. book, I was reported to Intergroup for using non-AA approved literature. So I've got that going for me, right? You know, you're not anything until you've been reported to Intergroup. So, and I mean, that book lit me up. And, you know, tonight I want to cover the doctor's opinion. I also want to go into, Happy Armistice Day. Today is Armistice Day. You know, it's a very big day in the world of Alcoholics Anonymous if you're into Bill's story in any way. So I think that's really cool that this is Armistice Day, and I'm going to talk about Bill's story. But first, the doctor's opinion. When you guys start a book, what page do you start on?
One.
XX. Roman numeral.
What? Yeah, you start on the Roman numeral. I'll give you a slap. I start on page one.
Right?
I don't read Roman numerals. I just got a book today, Don Quixote. This guy that's been coming to my house Monday night. I do a little big book thing Monday night, and people come to my house. I put up the garage door. Whoever shows up, 42 Sherwood Drive, you're welcome, New Providence. And usually, you know, a lot of nights I'm like, please, don't anybody show up. And somebody always shows up. At least, there was a hurricane. We had two guys show up. Guy lived like a quarter mile away. It took him like 45 minutes to get home that night because trees were down and everything. People are crazy. But the doctor's opinion, if you skip the doctor's opinion, you skip the definition of the problem. And what I never hear people talk about, it's the definition of the solution, is in the doctor's opinion. And the first thing that grabbed me in the doctor's opinion was the statement that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The cessation is so elusive that while they admit it's injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only... They are restless, irritable, and discontent. That restless, irritable, and discontent jumped out at me and said, that's you. Now, the scary thing is I was 10 plus years sober when this grabbed me. I was living my life restless, irritable, discontent, growing anxiety, rage. Yet, if on the outside, everything looked great. I had stopped drinking. I wasn't drinking. I was going to an AA meeting every day. I was an active member of the groups that I was going to. And I wasn't staying for the whole meeting, but I was an active member. And I was restless, irritable, discontent. I had gotten married in sobriety. My wife had children in sobriety. We bought a house. Within a very short period of time, I had a new car in the garage, the two-car detached garage to the house. I had all this stuff going for me, and I was like twisting in the wind. How am I gonna, you know? You make the mortgage payment, the first 3-4 mortgage payments, and you're like, I'm like walking into the house, going, how am I going to do this for 30 years? This is crazy. The money is just where? How is this going to? And one day it dawned on me as I was like walking up the drive. I said, Carl, this is the American dream. You just paid it yesterday. You got 28 days. Cut the crap, and it was during this time I had pneumonia. I had walking pneumonia, and I remember laying in my bed going through the sweats and thinking, oh my God, you know, God, why did you do this to me? Why did you give me a family? Why did you give me this house that's a burden? Why, you know, My secretary's calling me up going, you know, the cash balances are getting very low in the account. Now, I don't know anything about, I was the junior partner. I don't know about the receivables. I don't know about what's really, you know, I don't know the whole picture. I just got people telling me this stuff. And I am, like, going out of my mind. And it was during that time, I used to ask God to take this from me. And a lot of times he did. But I also was going to a doctor that was giving me, he thought he was doing me a favor. He gave me codeine cough medicine. And it was during this time, this is off of the doctor's opinion, kinda. It's not, though. It's non-alcoholic. I don't know, but it had like a shitload of codeine in it. And it says take a teaspoon or two teaspoons. And so I went into the drawer and I just grabbed the biggest spoon I could find. And I poured it and I went to take it and a drop hit the sink, which meant I had to take a second one to make up for the drop that hit that sink. And I remember going upstairs and sitting there and all of a sudden this feeling came over me. Not a buzz, but a feeling like, what are you worried about? Everything's going to be fine. Everything is going to be fine. And then I kind of nodded off, and I woke up like 3 or 4 hours later, terrified all over again. And my first thought was, where is that medicine? And a voice in my head said, you're going to need more this time. It's not going to do, and you're going to run out. You know about running out. You've run out, you know. And this, like I'm saying, 10 years sober, I'm going through shit like this. And so that restless, irritable, and discontent really grabbed me. But I'll tell you what's grabbed me recently. Okay, you know, the way the big book, the way the doctor's opinion is set up, you got two different fonts. The first font, this is Bill Wilson talking about Dr. Silkworth. And he gives Dr. Silkworth his introduction, his credentials. I don't know whether anybody thinks about the credentials, but a well-known doctor, he's the chief physician of a nationally prominent hospital specializing in alcoholic and drug addiction. Right? If you're a drug addict and you don't think this book applies to you, well, at least the doctor's opinion does, because this guy's a big shot. This guy was Central Park West. During the Depression, he had a job on Central Park West at Towns Hospital treating wealthy alcoholics and drug addicts. And one of the guys that he treats is Bill Wilson. And I guess I'm kind of jumping ahead. He kind of alludes to it. This guy has a spiritual experience in his hospital. It's at his third treatment. He gets there on December 11th, 1934. He's been drinking since Armistice Day, 1934, till December 11th. December 14th, he has his spiritual awakening. And as Silkworth says, in the course of his third treatment, he acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. I had a sponsee call me up today. He didn't like what somebody shared at the meeting. I'm like, dude. Doctor's opinion, Bill Wilson was saying he began to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. Not pass on my conceptions, Bill Wilson's conceptions. You gotta develop your own conceptions. And the way you do that is with living with the restlessness, the irritability, and the discontent, which is your alcoholism. Just because you stop drinking doesn't mean you're fixed. Shit gets better. You start to get stuff. And then you worry about losing the stuff. And then you worry about, I'm not getting the stuff I really want. Am I making enough? Am I good enough? Are they going to find me out? This is the stuff that goes through my head, right? So this sharing of conceptions has become the basis of the rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. Over 100 of them appeared to have recovered at this point. So, to me, this, I used to think this was like a fluff letter. I have people ask me to do letters. And you got to be careful what you say because you got to back this stuff up. So Silkworth kind of cut it off after sharing this little tidbit. And then Bill goes on to talk about how Silkworth's ideas made sense to him as a layperson. Because people have been asking us for centuries, what the hell is wrong with you? And we don't know. We don't know. They're telling us alcohol is your problem when alcohol was my solution. Alcohol and drugs were my solution. Without alcohol and drugs, I don't fit in my family. I don't fit in at school. I don't fit in with I just don't fit in. But with give me a little shot of alcohol. So the doctor had this theory about the allergy. And the allergy he called the phenomenon of craving. And I talked about it last week, I think, that in More About Alcoholism, you've got the Jim story. And Jim was the car salesman. He's working for the firm that he used to own. He lost the business. And he had made a start in Alcoholics Anonymous. A couple of guys had reached out to him. And he had failed to enlarge his spiritual life. And he picks up. And how he picks up, it's a very funny story. He decides after eating a sandwich and having a glass of milk, you know, if I put a shot of whiskey in that milk, it's not going to hurt me on a full stomach. He had the idea, he wasn't being so too smart. He puts the shot in the whiskey into his, and he drinks it. And he said, the experiment went so well, I had another. That to me is the definition of the phenomenon of craving. It's not drooling, it's not scraping, it's not this gnawing. The experiment, once I ingested it, it's the feeling I had when I took that codeine cough medicine. Everything's, what are you worried about? You're being stupid. This is going to be, it's going to be fine. Relax. Chill out, you know? The doctor, in the doctor's opinion, points out, if you have experienced the phenomenon of craving, you're an alcoholic. So if you don't want to be an alcoholic, you gotta, and you know, people that don't want to be alcoholics are very good at sidestepping things. But I know for me, how many times I sat down, I'm just going to have one or two, and boom, I was off. I didn't know when I was going to stop. It could be, I mean, I came in here 32 years old. I never had a days on, I had weekend where maybe I binged the whole weekend. But it wasn't like lost weekends. It wasn't horrible. But the definition of the alcoholic, if when you honestly want to, you find you can't quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably an alcoholic. If that be the case, you're screwed. You're screwed. Now, the doctor goes on to talk about the phenomenon of craving. And I like to point out, I talk in the jails a lot. And I like to point out to these guys, because I got a lot of dope fiends in there, a lot of heroin addicts, a lot of guys, and I did it last week. You know, before this book was published, there were no 12 steps. You know, Gamblers Anonymous is a 12-step fellowship. Narcotics Anonymous, 12-step fellowship. This book is unchanged since 1939. This is the pure shit. It has not been stepped on in any way. You're getting a raw dose. This has not been cut. You're getting the straight story from the day it was published in 1939. And the doctor's opinion. We have a nurse that comes to our dawn patrol meeting, and in an early meeting, she just said, "I'm blown away." She's been around doctors all her life. She hasn't seen a single opinion not change since 1939. She said this is the only one that she knows of that is totally unchanged, because these guys change their opinions like they change their socks. But the thing that I like to point out to them, to people, is these allergic types can never safely use. Should I be telling you what page this shit's on?
Yes.
Okay. XXVIII. That's 28 for you Italians. Right? So, these allergic types, we believe and so suggested a few years ago that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is the manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class. I assume everybody's in the class, right? Never occurs in the average tempered drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form. And once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon human, on things human, their problems pile up on them and they become astonishingly difficult to solve. The thing that can't use alcohol in any form, that's dry goods. To me, that's marijuana, that's pills, powders, whatever. Can't use alcohol in any form. If it's going to change me, change the way I feel, I can't use it. And my biggest nightmare is that I'm going to get hurt someday and wake up with a belly full of this stuff and it's like bye-bye, Carl. Because I don't want any part of it. Not that I like pain, but give me pain instead of this stuff. Because this stuff just doesn't cut it for me. And I'm a real alcoholic. I believe I'm a real alcoholic. The thing that gets me in this doctor, especially when Silkworth is writing, is he is blown away at the results Bill Wilson's getting. He's been trying to work with these people for years. Not a tremendous amount of years, but he's been working for years. He didn't want to work with drunks. He was doing something else when the depression hit, and he ended up working with drunks because it was a job. But the drunks that he was working with, they were so attractive to him that he became so fascinated, and it was a new eye on alcoholism. And the thing that he picked up that nobody else had ever picked up was the physical aspects of alcoholism. They all knew we were crazy, that with these huge burdens over our heads, we'd walk into the bar. I've sat in jail with guys that are telling me, my God, I shot a bag of dope. Never a dawn. As soon as I shot it, I go, You got to pee in a cup on Tuesday. What are you doing? You got a 5-year prison sentence hanging over your head, and you're shooting a bag of dope today, and it's got to be out of your system by Tuesday, and I don't know whether it's going to be out of my system. And it's like, yeah, that makes sense. Or the guy, the cops are coming up the stairs. He's locked himself in the bathroom to shoot a bag of dope. He's waiting for them to kick the door in, but he's getting that last fix. And he looked at me, he goes, that's crazy, right? I'm like, yeah, but I get it. I get it. This is, and I'm talking drugs and alcohol in any form. There's no loopholes on this stuff. And all of a sudden, this guy's coming and he's sharing his conception. He's sharing his story with people. And a couple of guys get it. A couple of guys. And on page 31, XXXI. The doctor says, what is the solution? Perhaps I can best answer this by relating one of my experiences. I had this buddy, Tommy, who just passed away this year. And he was quite a bit younger than me. And we used to go to that Berkeley Heights meeting. And we'd go out into the parking lot and he'd go, man, you know what I love? Like, what, Tommy? I like pulling the blinds of my apartment and cracking the seal on that pint of vodka and taking that first hit and feeling that vodka burn as it goes out. I'm like, Tommy, we just left a big book meeting. What the hell are you doing? Why, you're romancing this. He's like, yeah, but And Tommy was a chronic relapser. I always tell the story. He used to go to a bagel shop, and he'd use the bathroom just before they closed, and he'd take his car keys, and they had this plastic plant, and he'd lift the plant out of the cup, and he'd put his keys in there and then leave, so they'd lock his keys in there, so he knew when he got high he wasn't going to drive. And then he'd be there first thing in the morning to get his keys to go to work. And one day he calls me up. "Carl, I just read in the doctor's opinion. What is the solution? Perhaps I can best answer this. I've read it 10 frickin' times. I don't see the solution." And I said, "I'm going to have to call you back to see if I can see the solution." Because I had read this and I had never really... You know, solution doesn't come out and smack me in the face. But that day it did. I read it. And it talks about 1 year prior to the experience, a man was brought in to be treated for chronic alcoholism. His name was Hank Parkhurst. His story is in the first edition of the big book, The Unbeliever. If you don't have a first edition, go get one and read The Unbeliever. It's like a Twilight Zone episode. This guy was whack, and he was a big shot talking about his Cadillac and all the gears he's got on his Cadillac and all his girlfriends that he put through Towns Hospital. Real big shot. He had but partially recovered from a gastric hemorrhage and seemed to be a case of pathological mental deterioration. He had lost everything worthwhile in life, was only living, one might say, to drink. No solution there, right? He frankly admitted and believed that for him there was no hope. Welcome to the beginning of the solution. And I can back that up. Just wait, okay? Following the elimination of alcohol, step two of the solution, as outlined by the doctor, there was found to be no permanent brain injury. He accepted the plan outlined in this book. 1 year later, he called to see me, and I experienced a very strange sensation. Oh, by the way, that was part three of the solution. He accepted the plan outlined in this book. This guy, this Silkworth, was educated in Princeton. He had a frickin' job. Bill Wilson didn't have a job. But Bill Wilson wrote this book, and Silkworth is saying, this is the solution. It's outlined in this book. Okay? You can read the rest of that paragraph yourself later. That's your homework, and I'm going to give you a test on next time I'm here. Okay, when I need a mental uplift, I often think of another case brought in by a physician prominent in New York. The patient had made his own diagnosis and deciding his situation was hopeless. Step part one, right? This guy is Fitzmayo. Our southern friend. You can read his book. You can read his book, compare it to what this is saying here, okay? If you guys care. I don't know whether you care. It's a freaking workshop. I'm just, you know, I'm into this shit, right? The patient had made his own diagnosis, deciding his situation hopeless. He had hidden in a deserted bar, determined to die. He was rescued by a searching party and in desperate condition brought to me. Following his physical rehabilitation, which I equate to the elimination of alcohol, he had a talk with me in which he frankly stated he thought the treatment was a waste of effort, unless I could assure him, which no one ever had, that in the future he would have the willpower to resist the impulse to drink. His alcoholic problem was so complex and his depression so great, we felt the only hope would be through what we call moral psychology, and we doubted that even that would have any effect. However, he became sold on the ideas contained in this book. He has not had a drink in a great many years. I see him now and then, and he is as fine a specimen of manhood as one could wish to meet. Silkworth didn't sign this in the first edition of the big book because it was pretty radical. Nobody in written history, I've been told, I haven't gone over all of written history to make sure this is true, but I am told in written history the physical aspect of alcoholism had never been identified. This was radical, what he was saying. And he didn't want his name used. But in the second, third, and fourth edition, it was used. So how do you follow up the definition of the problem and the solution with an example of the problem and the solution? And that's Bill's story, where he talks, you know, here's a guy World War One. He's over in France, and on his way over there, this guy, he's the product of a divorced mother and father. And in Vermont, where he grew up, he had never met anybody that was divorced. His mom and dad were the only two. His dad took off to Vancouver to work in a quarry or something like that, and his mom went to medical school. His mom was a smart woman. And Bill was a pretty smart guy. He was raised by his grandfather. And you guys have heard the boomerang story, right? Boomerang, when he was a kid, his grandfather came to him and said, "Hey, here's a book about Australia, about the natives of Australia," and they throw this thing, this boomerang. He said, "There's no white guy, no American has ever made a boomerang that does. A boomerang's supposed to go, you throw it and it's supposed to come back to you, right?" And Bill, for the next 6 months, that's all he thought about was boomerangs. All he thought, he made boomerang after boomerang, and he'd throw it, and the thing would just go into the woods, and he'd and come back. And he finally cut a piece out of his headboard of his bed, and he made a boomerang that he threw, and the thing went around, did a perfect loop, and he came back and landed on it right at his feet. He never touched another boomerang for the rest of his life. He was done. He had succeeded. His grandfather one day comes down with a fiddle, said, I don't think you have an ear for music. I don't think you can play. He became, the leader of the band with his fiddle, right? Baseball, first day out on the baseball field. Somebody threw him the ball. He wasn't looking. Hit him in the head. Everybody laughed at him. He said, "I'll show you. I'm going to be the captain of the baseball team." Became the pitcher. This guy was a charger. He wanted to be the top man. And the one thing he never had a girlfriend. This isn't in Bill's story. This is as Bull sees it, as Carl sees it. Because I've read this stuff. I've got recordings of Bill Wilson talking about this. He finally gets a girlfriend. Bamford. What was her name? Something Bamford. And she was the minister's daughter. And over spring break or whatever, she was going to go to Massachusetts from Vermont to get some surgery. Bertha Bamford was her name. She must have been a honey, right? Bertha Bamford. School comes back in, and they call everybody into the auditorium, and they announce Bertha died during the surgery. And Bill Wilson falls apart, has what they call what he called the nervous breakdown. I don't know whether he's hospitalized, I don't know, but he went into such a depression over this. And he always thought that somehow it was associated with his alcoholism. That it was, when he was, I don't know how many members there were when this took place, but I have a recording of him like 15 years into after AA started. And he's talking about how these doctors had analyzed a lot of the early members because they wanted to see what the common trait of the alcoholism was. And Bill, all these guys are thinking, "Oh, we're smarter, we can make more money, we're better looking, we're all this stuff." And what the doctors came back with was childlike emotions coupled with grandiosity. And there's one other thing that I can't think of right now, but the childlike emotions and the grandiosity. And here's this guy who just fell apart when this girl died. And he said he really never got back on his feet until he met Lois. And he married Lois. He was a big shot, big stock analyst. A buddy of mine sent me this manuscript of two motorcycle hobos. And I'm thinking, I don't have time for this shit. What are you sending me the motorcycle hobos for? And it's the story of Bill and Lois on their motorcycle trip. And it's written by Lois, who was the sober one. So I found it very interesting, the way she presented this whole thing. And she never talked about his drinking until the very end of this diary, when he was really falling apart. But you know, he was falling apart the whole time. He couldn't pick up a drink without getting totally schnockered. And so, you know, he made a ton of money. I used to think he was living on Park Avenue, but he wasn't. He had an apartment. He and Lois had an apartment in Brooklyn, and the next door neighbor moved out. And he took that apartment too, knocked down the walls. Evidently, he had a butler, he had a maid, he had domestic help. He was doing really well. And then the stock market crash, he was in desperate straits. He ended up going up to Montreal, where he got back on his feet. And then he started drinking again, and he lost that job. He comes back. They talk about he'd get a job, get into a fight with a taxi driver. I can relate to stuff like that. Those taxi drivers are a pain in the ass. Or those guys on the Erie Lackawanna, what a bunch of jerks they are. I had to tell them off a couple of nights when I woke up in the Dover train yard wondering how I was going to get home. And on Armistice Day, right, 1934, today, Bill Wilson was going to play golf in Staten Island, and he was taking the bus. And he had his golf clubs, and there was a guy on the bus that had I assume it was a shotgun. I think the guy was shooting clays, and Bill started asking about a shotgun. It's like, oh yeah, I shot a lot of squirrels up in Vermont. Yeah, and they, you know, and then talking about the war and things like that, and these guys they were bullshitting, and all of a sudden the bus was in an accident, and it was right in front of a speakeasy, and these two guys they you know, Bill Wilson and this guy, they go into the speakeasy, and the guy orders, he's like, oh my god, I'm a little shaken up. He goes, give me a highball, you know, give me a scotch. And Bill comes in and says, give me a ginger ale. And the guy looks at him and goes, ginger ale? Really? Really? A ginger ale? You're drinking it. Don't you drink? Bill's like, well, if you want to know about drinking, I can tell you about drinking. I'm an alcoholic. I've been hospitalized twice. My doctor tells me I'm going to drink myself to death if I take so much as another drink. He goes, if I take the drink, I'll have to be hospitalized. And he went into great detail, phenomenon of craving, told him the whole nine yards. You know, when Bill first met Silkworth, and Silkworth laid this stuff out for him, he said, that's the answer. That's the answer. Just don't pick up the first drink. But it was not. You know, self-knowledge will avail you nothing with this disease. Because it's a mental illness. It's a big mental illness. A lot of people focus on this physical stuff. Oh, don't drink no matter what. Whoa, you know. That's why I go to the jail. I like to go with the guys that drink no matter what. You know, I like to hang out with those guys. Because that scares the crap out of me. Because I've got what they got. So he tells this guy. And then all of a sudden, the bartender comes over. He goes, it's Armistice Day. And the bar was filling up. And all the veterans are coming in. And they're talking about the war. And Bill's thinking back. Bill said his head goes back to in France, the day that armistice was signed, about the bells ringing in the church towers and about the bottles of wine and the mademoiselles. And he was just, oh, romanticizing the whole thing. And the guy comes over with two drinks, and he lays them down and says, happy Armistice Day, boys. These are on the house. Bill picked it up, and he banged that sucker down. And the guy looks at him. He goes, You've got to be out of your frickin' mind. After what you just told me, you're going to pick up that drink and you just drank it like that? And Bill looked at him and said, yeah, I am. And the next day, Lois had to step over him on the way to her job at the department store. And he's dragging the golf clubs and he had a gash in his head and he was bleeding. And he was off to the races because he was sober. He had been sober for a while before this golf outing, which I probably should have added. He wasn't drinking at the time, as you could tell. But that was the thing that really kicked him off. That really kicked him off was that Armistice Day. And that's where Ebby found him. And, you know, this time of year kind of sucks, right? It's getting cold. A lot of times it's rainy. It's kind of dreary. They change the clocks and shit. But in the story, near the end of that bleak November, I sat drinking in my kitchen with a certain satisfaction. I reflected that I had enough gin concealed around the house to carry me through that night and the next day. My wife was at work. I wondered if I dared hide a full bottle near my bed, the head of my bed. And then he gets a call from Ebby. And Ebby's like, hey, I'd like to come over and see you. And Bill's like, yeah. That's excellent. You're a loser too. You come on over. I'm on the balls of my... This guy, he knows he's kicked it off again. He knows what it means, insanity or death. And he's kicked it off again. And his buddy's going to come over and they can bullshit about the old times, about the old days, about how they chartered the flight up to Vermont and landed at the landing strip, and they thought the marching band was for them, but it wasn't. It was because they were going to open the airfield the next day. And the pilot and these two jerks fall out of the plane so drunk, and they're standing at attention as the parade's going by. So he can't wait. He can't wait. And Ebby comes in. And he's sober. Bill's like, what's up with that? And he sits down. He pushes the glass of gin across the table to Ebby. And Ebby's like, no thanks, Bill. I'm not drinking. Pushes it back. Ebby, he's like, what? You're the biggest drinker I know. What are you talking about? You're not drinking. He goes, I haven't had a drink in 2 months. He goes, what got into you? He goes, I got religion. Bill said it was like getting hit in the face with a wet mop. The idea that this guy, I got a religious nut in my house who's going to talk to me about God. The last thing I want to hear is about God. I want no part of this. But then he said, you know what? What brand? And he's like, what? He goes, what brand? What brand you got? Because Bill's already figured, I got twice as much gin now. My gin's going to last longer than this guy can talk. And Ebby goes, it wasn't really a brand. He said he did no ranting. In a matter-of-fact way, he told how two men had appeared in court persuading the judge to suspend his commitment. They had told of a simple religious idea and a practical program of action. That was 2 months ago, and the result was self-evident. It worked. Bill wanted to be sober more than anything else in the world. He wanted to get back on his feet. He wanted to get back on the power drive. And here's this guy sitting across from him at his kitchen table saying, hey, I haven't had a drink in 2 months. And he wasn't sweating the fact that there was a glass of gin right there with his name on it. And Bill started talking to him about it. He goes, what's this all about? What was the idea? And Ebby told him, he said, they told me I had to get honest with myself like I never had before, and I had to stop living alone. I had to talk it out with one person. I have to be willing to make restitution for the harms I've done. I got to start practicing a form of giving that demands absolutely nothing in return. And even if it's just an experiment, I have to ask God for guidance. Those are the four things, and I'm not making that up. That's Bill Wilson on his tapes. Go listen to his tapes. He says something similar to that on just about every tape. And he's looking at these. Had the power originated in him? Obviously, it had not. There had been no more power in him than there was in me at that minute, and that was none at all. And that floored me. And he starts talking, and then he goes back to the hospital. You know, in between this meeting, there was another meeting. Shep Cornell was one of the guys that had stepped in for Ebby, and he and Ebby had gone and 12-step, and Bill didn't like Shep, but he liked Ebby. He liked Ebby. And then Bill goes down to Calvary Church. He's down on 24th Street in Manhattan. Shows up there. Calvary Mission is where Ebby's staying, like the Market Street Mission up in Morristown. You should go up there, check it out. Sing songs to Jesus some night. It's very moving. And Bill had gone down there, and he had gone up and testified that night, and that he was giving his life to God and all this stuff. And then he had gone to Towns Hospital a couple of days later and showed up at Towns Hospital waving a bottle of beer in the air saying, "I got something this time, Doc. I think I really got something." And the doctor said, "Yeah, you do. You better go upstairs and go to bed." And that was December 11th, 1934. 3 days later, Ebby came, talked to him, gave him the formula again. You've got to get honest with yourself like you never have before, and you got to stop living alone. You got to be willing to make restitution for the harms you've done. You've got to start practicing a form of giving that demands absolutely nothing in return. And even if it's just an experiment, you have to ask God for guidance. And if you read Bill's story, if you look for it, you can see him take step one on page 8. "No words can tell the loneliness and despair I found in the bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master." Step one. Step two. "It was only a matter of being willing." This is Ebby had come to him and pointed out to him. He said, "Hey," and what's very interesting, which this is just a side note, you think Bill wrote Bill's story. On this page, "Despite the living example of my friend, there remain to me the vestiges of my old prejudice." This was written on the border of the original manuscript. And this guy Barry, who had the original manuscript, went to the archivist, Nell Wing, and said, "What is this?" And she goes, "I recognize that handwriting. That's Hank Parkhurst wrote this," who went on to die from his alcoholism. He picked up after the book was published. And this idea, why don't you choose your own concept of God? You know, Bill's idea of presenting his concepts to others, impressing upon them that they must do likewise. It's all about our concepts. If you have a problem with God, I suggest you look at your concept of God. And you start to seek a concept that you can stomach. I thank God I can stomach what we talk about in here. I had several friends that went running out of this room as soon as they heard the word God. They can't accept that. I see guys today with lots of years that I think their concept of God sucks. Thank God I don't have to live with that. That my concept of God is working very well. I've worked for that. I did a lot of seeking. You know? A, I'm an alcoholic. I can't manage my own life. B, that probably no human power could relieve my alcoholism. C, that God could and would if he were sought. I did a lot of seeking. I'm a pussy. I'm afraid somebody's going to back me into a corner. Come on. Defend your position on this God thing. Come on. So I had to go read Emmett Fox. I had to go read C.S. Lewis. I had to go read St. Augustine's Confessions. You know, St. Augustine, he was a teacher of rhetoric, of argument. And he used to think he was an intellectual. His mom used to tell him, you got to find Jesus. He's like, "Mom, please, we laugh at you people walking on water, doing all that stuff, you know, changing water into wine. That's such a bunch of..." And, you know, a lot of... C.S. Lewis was a debater. He was a teacher. He had to debate his point with his uncle growing up. And he couldn't debate against the believers. And St. Augustine became a believer. And these are smart, smart guys. I had to get these guys in my corner. I had to read, what is their concept? Can I wrap my head around some of this stuff? And so Bill's presented with this. And in step two, it was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required for me to make my beginning. Step three, he's in the hospital. This dude's in the hospital. Oh, don't take the steps too frickin' quick. Oh, my God, because you got to do them perfectly. You got to write that perfect four step. Give me a frickin' Then I humbly offered myself to God, as I then understood him, to do with me as he would. I placed myself unreservedly under his care and direction. I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing, that without him I was lost. I ruthlessly faced my sins, step four, and became willing to have my newfound friend take them away root and branch. I have not had a drink since. My schoolmate visited. I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies. Do you think this was like an A-rated fifth step? Nah. This is just knocking the crud off the top. But you know what? We do the best we can. I see people just browbeat people. You're not doing it. You're not doing it right. Hey, there's a bunch of wounded animals coming in here, giving up their best friends. They don't need that shit. I'll tell you, I thank God for the meetings. Just don't drink, go to meetings. There was a guy, we had the third and the seventh step prayer written up in calligraphy, right? These beautiful prayers on these big, we'd come in the morning and they would be turned to the wall. Like, what's up with, I don't want to scare the newcomers away. What, are you freaking kidding me? Booze is going to chase them back. They got no place to go. They're beautiful prayers. But, hey, some people need that. Some people need that. And I'm glad it's there for them. Because I think that's what I needed. I don't think I could have taken the having this stuff jammed down my throat. But you can tell, you know, I love this stuff. I love to see this. I love to point it out. So fifth step five, he takes step five. We made a list of people I had hurt towards whom I felt resentment. Step eight, I expressed a willingness to approach these individuals, admitting my wrong. Never was I to be critical of them. I was to test my thinking of God consciousness within. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense. I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems. Step 10 and 11, right? And as soon as he got out, he's asking Silkworth, can I come back and talk to your patients? And with some misgivings, they consented. And they were blown away at the results he was getting. He got Hank Parkhurst, got sober. And this wasn't AA. They're going to the Oxford group. And the Oxford group wasn't really receiving them very well because they keep bringing drunks into the Oxford group. They're looking for Wall Street people to come in. So, Evie comes back. Bill's had this spiritual awakening, and he brings them varieties of religious experience. If you've ever tried to read the book, you're a better person than me because I've been able to skim through, read little pieces and stuff because it's not all about drunks. It's about people having spiritual experiences, and it's a tough read. The doctor, he calls the doctor after the spiritual experience. He has the spiritual experience after taking these steps in the hospital, and he calls the doctor, and the doctor says, you seem different. You better hang on to it, you know? And which is an unbelievable thing that he didn't find some narcotic to just knock him out, you know? And Ebby comes back and he emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs, step 12 here. Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead, he said, how appallingly true for the alcoholic. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again, and if he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that. And, you know, people came to Bill for years saying, dude, you have the room lit up? You felt this wind blowing through? When am I going to get mine? How come I did what you did in the hospital? When am I, why? You know? And you would think, a guy like Bill, right? He'd be on Easy Street after this. God was in his frickin' hospital room. The room lit up. He was in the presence of God. So what happened? He found little work. I was not too well at the time, was plagued by waves of self-pity and resentment. This sometimes nearly drove me back to drink. But I soon found that when all other measures failed, work with another alcoholic would save the day. Many times I have gone to my old hospital in despair. On talking to a man there, I would be amazingly lifted up and set on my feet. It's a design for living that works in rough going. And that's something I always carry with me. I can't believe the whole frickin' hour's gone. But, you know? And that's good because, I mean, I'm basically done. You know, an alcoholic in his cups is an unlovely creature. Our struggles with them are variously strenuous, comic, and tragic. One poor chap committed suicide in my home. He could not or would not see our way of life. I've seen people die. I think the lucky ones die. I think the unlucky ones pick up and they can't stop. They lose. They've lost the power to choose whether or not they drink, and that's a nasty thing. And so, I think I said it last week. You know, I go to a lot of these big book studies. I was there this morning, and when people say, "Gee, I haven't read that doctor's opinion in like a year." I'm like, are you a year? How can you go a year with not reading this? Aren't you talking to other people? Aren't you presenting this to other people? Aren't you sharing your concepts with other people? How can you not go, you know, just be ripping through that freaking thing about the different, you know, where am I in the definitions there? Where am I? And you know where I'm the psychopath that they talk about in the doctor's opinion. Always making I'm all upset about it. Never making a decision. Never doing anything about it. You know? You got to get into this stuff. Because I'll tell you, for a dummy newcomer to write a book like this, this guy had 1939. He got sober in, December 11th, 1934. That's not a lot of time. And the cohorts that were writing it with them, they all had less time. And they were crazy. They're all crazy. We're all crazy. But, you know, when I do something like this, no matter what's going on in my life, when I leave here, I'm amazingly lifted up and put back on my feet. It's a design for living that works. And thank you for letting me share.
Thank you.